Jay-Z and Alicia Keys with Empire State of Mind, singing about New York. And in that iconic city, there isn't a more iconic magazine than The New Yorker. First published in 1925, The New Yorker is a celebration of life and culture and ideas and style in that great city. In the words of its editor, David Remnick, the magazine delivers, this is the quote, deep information, real examination, and the type of reporting that takes time. Well, this morning we're joined by two of the magazine's stalwarts. They are guests at the Melbourne Writers' Festival. Sasha Freer-Jones is one of the New Yorker's music critics. Sasha, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. And cartoonist Roz Chast. Pleasure to have you in the studio, Roz.
Oh, nice to be here.
Sasha, let's start with you. The magazine has many devoted readers here. I'm one of them. I wonder, when you write, are you aware that you're engaged in an international conversation, or does it feel much more local to you?
No, I think of a large audience. The pieces have to make sense to anybody, and if you don't know what I'm talking about before you come in, that's okay. That's built into the writing. I assume that you don't necessarily know that much, and I'm not thinking of one country or another, but I'm definitely writing for people who are not immediately conversant with pop.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Roz? I mean, I've been laughing at cartoons in The New Yorker since I guess I encountered them in a magazine in a doctor's waiting room when I was a young man. I suppose that's where it started. Does it feel distinctively like a New York kind of humor?
I'm not really sure. I think humor is so personal that I'm really writing about and drawing about things that make me laugh and that I think are funny. And I don't really worry too much about what other people are going to think is funny, because it varies so much from person to person. I think you can make yourself sort of nuts. So I'm really kind of it's almost like passing notes. Like, I think this is funny,
right.
You know, like, do you think this is funny? Because I think this is really funny.
Yeah, I've got you. So how did you come to be working on The New Yorker?
I always liked to draw cartoons from the time I was really little. And by the time I got out of art school, I had sort of thought there was no way I could make my living being a cartoonist. And I tried to take my portfolio around as an illustrator and didn't have much luck. But I did know that The New Yorker used cartoons. So I had been selling some cartoons to The Village Voice, to The National Lampoon. And in April of 1978, I called up. I found out when The New Yorker's drop-off day was. And I dropped off a portfolio. I really did not think they were going to buy anything, but they did. And I've been working for them since.
And is that how it works? They pay you by the item, do they?
Yes. Yes, they do.
So would you deliver like four or five cartoons in any one drop and they would choose one or two? How does it work?
More like when I first started, we call them batches.
Right.
Artists, cartoonists drop off between like maybe 5 and 15 drawings a week. And then if you're lucky, they choose one. Maybe a couple of times a year, if you're super lucky, they choose two. But often they choose none, and then you just don't get paid.
Right. But then you walk down the street to The Village Voice, do you, and say, do you reckon this is funny?
Yes. Well, that was in the olden days. This was before my time. In the golden age of cartooning, I was told that cartoonists would make the rounds. They would start out at The New Yorker because they paid the most. And then they would work their way down, you know, to the Saturday Evening Post and McCall's and Collier's and all these places that, you know, were no longer publishing by the time I started. And then they'd work their way down to the bottom and they'd wind up at Gent.
Gent.
I don't think I know Gent.
What's know Gent. I think it was a kind of like boobs sort of magazine.
Oh, I see Gent. Oh, that kind
Gent.
Of Gent.
Now yeah, including boobs. boobs aplenty. So that was all gone by the time I sort of started being in this business. But people do make the rounds. And the stuff that, you know, the arrangement I have with The New Yorker, I feel like I'm blabbing away here, but the arrangement I have with The New Yorker is first refusals. I have a contract, and that means that what I don't sell to them, what they reject, I am free to sell to them.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And Sasha, how did you get into it?
Well, I wrote a letter. Now, I didn't know that this had done anything until 2 years into my being a staff writer, but I wrote a letter in the early, I don't know, it might have been 2001 or two, and I said how much I loved the magazine. I just expressed some concern that maybe the pop writing wasn't quite up to the level of the rest of the magazine, which is a bit cheeky, but I guess that's what I thought at the time. And I didn't know that that had even been read. I think I got a – I figured out – the way that you figured out the drop-off date, I figured out David Remnick's email address. And I do remember getting a thanks. And then I thought, why in the world would he read a letter? Come on. And granted, again, now, he didn't tell me this until many years later. And then in 2004, I got a call. And he said, I think we need some help. Come on down. Very casual. Oddly, I went down. And it was right near my birthday in 2004. And he said, you know, why don't you write a few pieces? And then after three pieces, they hired me. And then it was about 2 years later that he admitted that the letter had had a lot to do with it. But I had no idea. At the time, I'd been, I think, Slate's music critic. In fact, they had just made me the music critic after a year of freelancing. And then David swooped in and screwed that up.
For that letter to work, you've had to tick two boxes, don't you? You've got to convince him that what he's doing at the moment is no good.
Right.
And then you've got to convince him that you're the man to fix it.
It wouldn't have been very convincing to say, you know, I think that stuff you're doing on Iraq, really weak. Like, that wouldn't have worked, you know? Yeah. That Israel stuff, it's not working. So that would have gotten nowhere. No, I mean, it was a weak spot. And so, you know, as he said, I wrote my own job description and that helped him. I mean, every editor, when you're in the position of putting together a book and you're just trying to have it work and have, you know, the copy get in, you want someone who knows what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So I fooled him into thinking that I did, which was not entirely true, but I had a genius editor named John Bennett, who's been with the magazine for a long time, and he was gentle and loving enough to get my crazy mind into the magazine and have it sound like me and sound like the magazine, which is a happy battle that you're always working with at the magazine, because it has a house style, but then it's full of all these weirdos who do different things, and there's a genius staff of sort of people to keep us on life support.
So what is that? I mean, that ethos, that style, that...
I mean, what's the point of all that?
Like, what is it? I mean, I, in the introduction, I made some big claims about what The New Yorker is, but what do you think is the kind of defining...
No, those claims are true. We have a license to kill. No, you know, it's really about clarity and reporting and being concrete. You learn a lot of really valuable things if you didn't know them already as a writer. There are phrases that come up a lot with any editor, like mind reading. One thing you'll notice if you pick up especially really bad arts journalism is you'll see people attributing intentionality to a piece of work, and you don't actually know ever what anyone meant with a piece of art. You can say what it does. You can say what you hear. You can say what you think it's doing. But people blithely attribute
intentions. Yeah, we'll say the artist is trying to do this. Let's measure how well that artist has achieved their intention.
I mean, these are very minor changes in language, but they mean a great deal. And those are the things you look out for. And reporting has to be absolutely, completely rock solid. And, you know, you develop habits that are good habits. But within that, you can then use whatever style you want. And you can get away with as many bad words as you can and as many jokes as you think work. And, you know, but you go back and forth. It's not a stern sort of like going to the principal's office kind of thing. I mean, there's a lot of back and forth.
This is Books Nights Daily on RN. And because the Melbourne Writers' Festival is on, we're celebrating the New Yorker magazine because there are lots of people from the New Yorker in Melbourne. And we're talking to Sasha Frere-Jones, who's one of the New Yorker's music critics. He's the pop music critic, and also cartoonist Roz Chast. Has it changed much over the years, or are you more struck by the continuities that the magazine has managed to maintain in a changing world, Roz?
I think that there is a sort of overarching cohesion between different eras, and some of this really does have to do with the style, which I don't think I could completely put into words, but the sort of style of The New Yorker. But, of course, every editor has his or her own field that, you know, the thing that they love the most, the direction they want to pull the magazine towards. But I think that all editors, I've worked under William Shawn, Bob Gottlieb, Tina Brown, and David Remnick. And in some ways it's been different, but in some ways it's been remarkably similar. I think that there really is something about The New Yorker where they do bring together all of these, I really can only speak for the art department, sort of different voices and different approaches, and hopefully allow all of us to be our best selves.
I mean, the paradox of the magazine seems to me that on the one hand, it's terribly current. Like, you feel like you're knowing, you're discovering what's going on in New York now.
Yeah.
That, you know, someone's playing in this basement and someone else is doing jazz here and there's a play on there. And,
yeah.
And these are the issues we're discussing in town at the moment. I feel like I'm on the pulse of New York. And yet, in another way, it's a kind of old-fashioned
yes,
looking
I think
magazine.
It's both.
That's kind of paradoxical.
It's the timely and also the timeless. And I think that that is something that anyone who works for The New Yorker, that's what you're trying to sort of combine. You know, knowing you don't want to become a sort of fossilized, museumized version of, you know, what people think New York is. Or, you know, I think some people have this illusion that we're just – you know, the Round Table and the Algonquin, of course, was so famous, and it's like, that's what New Yorker writers do. After, you know, noon, they go to the Algonquin and sit around a table and drink martinis and say impossibly witty things to each other for the next, you know, 6 hours. And, you know, that as far as the people I know, none of us do that. I think a lot of tourists go to the Algonquin, but that's not the New Yorker, but anyway.
I'll get some tips from you later. I'm going to be there in 2 weeks. We're taking the show to New York in a couple of weeks, so I'm up for tips. Now, one of the joys of my life is that I own a copy of the complete cartoons of The New Yorker, which comes with a two CDs, which apparently contain the 68,647 cartoons that have been published by the magazine up until that date. I've never counted them, to be honest. I don't know whether I've been ripped off or not. But the one thing I noticed that is that over the decades, the cartoons seem to have got funnier. I reckon I laugh a lot more at the new ones. I find the old ones kind of quaint. Do you think it's just because senses of humour have changed, or do you think...
Oh, I think senses of humour. I think certain things definitely change senses of humour. I mean, that's one of the odd things about humour is that it really... what was really funny, you know, in the 20s, I love, you know, Peter Arno's drawings, but I don't find myself laughing so much at the jokes.
I wonder whether they were funny or whether people had a different response, whether there was a satire or a knowingness or a wickedness to them that was different from just saying, hey, here's something funny.
I think it changes. I think it's, you know, I think that senses, you know, of what's funny change over the years. I think some things stay the same. Some things are always going to be funny. Slapstick, to me, is generally pretty funny, although I don't really do it too much in my cartoons. But, you know, I mean, I can watch that. There's an old Laurel and Hardy film where they're trying to move a piano up this incredibly steep staircase, and the piano keeps falling down the stairs. And I don't know why, but that really makes me laugh. But there's definitely, it changes.
I think you know you're on the wavelength of an era when you get its cartoons. I mean, I was thinking, one of your cartoons from 2002 is called The Botox Theatre.
Oh.
And it's a stage, and on the back of the stage are two huge masks, like the mask of tragedy and the mask of comedy. But instead of one of them grinning and the other one frowning, they have no expression at all because it's the Botox Theatre.
Yeah.
Actually, it's really funny. But, you know, in 50, 100 years' time, people won't even know what Botox was, hopefully.
No, that's true. That's true. They won't. They won't. But, you know, I think that if you go about making your cartoons sort of worrying about what's going to be funny in 50 years, I think, you might as well kill yourself.
Oh, yeah, they have to be ephemeral. The one that caught my eye yesterday as I was looking back through that, there was a cartoon in 2004 by Matthew Diffie, and it's Che Guevara looking very heroic.
Oh,
Che Guevara.
Yeah, yeah.
He's wearing a T-shirt, and on the T-shirt, there's the face of Bart Simpson.
Yeah.
So what kind of T-shirt does Che Guevara wear? Oh, he wears a Bart Simpson T-shirt.
Yeah.
I don't even know why that's funny.
Yeah.
Sasha, I'm sort of fascinated by the way in which the magazine has this ability to embrace culture of all kinds. So you've got opera on the one hand, you've got pop music on the other. I can't think of many forums, apart from this show actually, that are comfortable at just going across the whole range.
And
do you think that's a distinctively New York thing?
I'd hate to generalize either about the city or other magazines, but I think if the magazine has a mission, and I don't want to speak out of turn because that's David's lookout. I think the idea is that every issue, if you pile up a whole year, if you have read them all, you will have a fairly decent idea of what actually happened in the world in 1 year. I mean, it's not actually that New York-centric a magazine when we're thinking about it and talking about what's going to go into it. I mean, the front of the book is about the city, but the rest of it is very much international and it's for everyone. And we're just trying to, in the slots we have, I mean, there are, I guess, about 46 issues maybe we do. And then as columnists, we get, 15 to 20 tries, and we've got to slice that pizza in a way that we think represents. I mean, you look back on the year and you think, oh, I gave too much attention to one thing and I missed another thing. But the idea is to be as representative as possible, because if you only read one magazine, which is, of course, our dream, that you not ever read anything else. Yeah. I mean, they do stack up, so it's a lot to read. But I think the idea is
Bird Talk.
And Gent, of course.
Yes, and Gent.
You've got a whole backlog of Gent to read.
And
so,
Highlights for Children.
And Cat Fancy. So
that's right.
Between those, general interest is something I think it's a bland sounding term, but I think we take it very seriously. Like, there are discussions week to week. Like, have we done this? Do people already know this? If this has been caned to death in the press, can we add anything?
But there is also a sense that you represent a kind of quality in a world that's doing something a little bit crasser. I mean, you write a fantastic review and historical piece on the pioneering electronic group Kraftwerk recently on the occasion of their retrospective at MoMA.
Yeah, that was fun.
And I thought that was just a wonderful piece of writing.
Oh, thank you.
Can you talk about what you were trying to do?
See a lot of Kraftwerk. That was pretty monumental in that they're one of my favorite bands. They're the first band that the museum had ever presented as the same way they presented a visual artist. They'd never had a pop act. Klaus von Biesenbach, was it just Klaus Biesenbach? Did I add the Von? Anyway, Klaus, the director, was very emphatic about it not being a series of concerts, about it being an exhibition the way you would have, Rothko or anyone else. And so that was exciting, and I got to meet Ralph, who's the one remaining member of Kraftwerk, and they are, I think, one of the greatest bands of any kind ever. So, I mean, that was just a pure joy to see them work through that and see every single show and watch people. It's a band with so much investment in its fans and the people who went every night that it was a really joyful thing to watch them.
And when you're writing, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I get the feeling that
you could put 1,500 words into my mouth by tomorrow morning, that would be really helpful.
I'll do it for you and send you an invoice. It seemed to me that you do draw a discrimination, or you do discriminate between stuff that's popular and stuff that somehow has something smart about it. That stuff can
those aren't mutually exclusive things.
No, they're not. But sometimes popular stuff is also a bit dumb. And I can read you saying, people – you don't think so?
Not really, no. I mean, I can count many more dumb indie acts than I can really popular acts. But, go on. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm wondering what it is that you're looking for in pop music, because you do discriminate. It's not simply people playing in tune.
That sometimes being in tune is definitely a downside. It's really more me thinking about, I hate to use the same analogy twice, but I've got, with me, it's actually usually closer to 16. So that's my pizza pie. And I'm thinking of you at home, you've got a year, and I'm pretending, which is of course a myth, especially with the internet. But like, if you had only read these 16 columns, because there are people who are not that big on the internet and they love the New Yorker, okay, let me try to give you a sense of what happened this year. But in the course of that year, I'm going to talk about a couple of big acts that may not matter to me, but I know that they're making a huge impact. And then I'll throw in a few people who are just passionate loves of mine that, I maybe know that you're not going to go out and buy this or ever hear it. It might be a bit too noisy for you or whatever, but I know that I love them and I think they're of enough value that over time I want them to be on the books there.
Yeah.
And, you're going to get always when you see the metrics on the web, if you write about a big person like Lady Gaga, I added a vowel in there, or Beyonce, that will be a popular piece, but that's because you're talking about a popular artist. Right. I mean, that's sort of one-to-one correlation.
I get that. And you do that balancing.
But it's guessing. I often look back at a year, or not often, but if I were to look back at a year every now and then, I sometimes think, why did I waste a column on that guy? And like, how in the world did I not write about that record? Like, what is wrong with me?
What is wrong
with me? There's a rapper who I love from Detroit named Danny Brown, who I loved the moment he came out. And for reasons that are completely obscure to me, myself, I don't remember why I didn't do a column on him. I mean, eventually I will.
Will you?
He's fantastic. But I just didn't, which is dumb.
What about this stuff about fact-checking and editing? The magazine's famous
for it. It's all made up. None of it's true. There's nobody there. It's just me and Roz and a fax machine.
We check each other's stuff.
Exactly.
Is that right? How do you spell this, mate? You say.
I say that doesn't look like a couch.
So what happens? I mean, you hand in the draft of your copy.
Mm-hmm.
What then happens to it?
How much time do we have? Anyway, here, I'm going to give you a number. Actually, I'm going to give you a really quick answer. The real joy of writing for The New Yorker, which makes it very hard to think of writing for anyone else, is that there's a huge layer of people. It's not even just your editors and your OKers and your fact checkers. Sort of everyone on the editorial floor, which is the 20th floor, can get a look at a thing. And you often, when you get your final draft, it'll be a PDF and there'll be a number at the end, a suffix. And before it says PDF, it'll say maybe 17 or 18, meaning you've gone through that many drafts. And really the joy of The New Yorker and the strength of it is so many different people are offering opinions and checking facts and words and pushing back on you. And at the end of the day, you and the editor have final say, and you can say, no, that was the heart of the piece. You have to put that back in. Or, no, you're absolutely right. That's daft. Take that out. Or we're running out of space. That's just another reference that's going to bog it down. Like, pull it. And you just got so much input, and it's all smart. And, you know, factual errors are very – it's hard to make them when you have such assiduous, brilliant people making them. And probably the only errors that have ever entered are when there's a phrase called on author. Like, you get to a point where I'm alleging that there's a musical thing that happens. I once did something phenomenally embarrassing with Led Zeppelin that I don't want to talk about, where they come back and they say, well, look, I'm not a musician, and I am. And they say, are you sure there's no bass line in that song? And I groggily from London say, no, it's, you can put that on me, I'm sure. And then, you know, the piece runs, and I think, oh, my God. But, you know, that's the case of the fact checker trying to save me and me throwing
you wake up at 2 o'clock and you can hear a bass line, you hear boom.
A bass line that I've actually played
doom,
myself.
Doom.
Yeah,
I think that's it. That's
unbelievable.
The baseline.
But no, they're usually right, and you know it only really goes wrong if you somehow insist that your perception is right.
Do fact checkers ever get their talons into cartoons, or are they free of fact?
They're definitely not checked in the same way that the written pieces are. We use so many fewer words, for one thing. But they do check things like if you're using a fake name in your cartoon or something to make sure that somebody like that doesn't exist. Although I have had I once got a letter from somebody, and I can't remember his name, but it was so-and-so, and the joke was that they were independently broke instead of independently rich. And it turned out that there was Thurston Pendleton. That's what it was. It was Thurston Pendleton, and it was this absurd name that I just pulled out of the air. And then I got a letter from a guy whose name was Thurston Pendleton. I'm sorry. I didn't get the letter. The New Yorker got the letter, and he was very angry. And I got a call from Joe Cooper, who was the lawyer at the time, and he said, well, how did you come up with the name Thurston Pendleton? Because they do check to make sure there is no, and there hadn't been one. And I said, okay, I'm thinking, how did I come up with Thurston? Okay, I was thinking, and luckily I remembered that I was looking for like a name that sounded sort of rich. And of course, this was from Gilligan's Island,
Thurston
the rich
Howell.
Guy, Thurston
yeah.
Howell. So
the
I had third. Thurston, and what sounds good with Thurston? Well, Pendleton. And then I thought, when I thought about it later, I thought it was probably because of the actor, Austin Pendleton. So I put together Thurston Pendleton. And but it turned out that not only was there a Thurston Pendleton, but he also read The New Yorker and read this cartoon and was incensed enough to write a letter. And I don't know whether he threatened to sue, but it was like some absurd thing. And luckily, you know, I remembered how I came up with the name, and Joe Cooper got back to him, and everything sort of settled down.
Thurston Pendleton may be listening now because you can podcast everything.
I know. Evidently, he and I are connected in some serious way.
Good morning, Thurston. It's nice to have you with us.
Yeah, I didn't mean anything by it.
Talking of going digital, The New Yorker's gone digital. It's available on iPad. as of this year. Is that going to be an advantage
for the iPhone?
Is that going to be an advantage for your column, Sasha? How's it going to change the magazine and the way it's received?
I mean, well, there are several changes that are. I mean, I think the biggest change is what we're doing on the website, because that's so infinitely expandable. But you know, on the iPad, it's retains roughly the same format, except it scrolls down rather than horizontally, and there's often an audio or a video extra with the columns, and that's true for many, many of the pieces. Like I just filed a column about the band One Direction, and if I were home, I would be doing a small little talking bit about the band and boy bands, and we'd play a bit of a song, but I'm here. So that's an added thing, and I don't know the metrics. I don't know how many people listen to it or enjoy it, but, you know, it's different. The iPhone app actually came out a few weeks ago, and it's gorgeous looking. It's incredibly handy. I'm really blown away. I mean, I sound like I'm, you know, selling the company brand, but the job they did is really fantastic. And I think that matters a huge amount to people, because people sure do like smartphones, and if you make it really easy to read something on a phone and they're on the train and it's right there automatically. I mean, I know that I will. I've now, you know, both times it's popped up, I just will look and there's the new issue, and I just start going through it before I get to the office and I pick up my copy.
Well, Sasha and Roz, it's been great to have you in the studio. Thanks for coming by.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Been good to meet you. Two people whose work I've enjoyed for such a long time. I've been talking to New Yorker pop music critic Sasha Frere-Jones and cartoonist Roz Chast.